officially on summer vacation, but it has been a working vacation. I've been doing an average of about a show a week, and this allows me to bring on people who need to be heard from. And I've had a number of new guests, people that I hadn't had on the show before this summer, and we're continuing that tradition today. We're going to be discussing a common topic on this show, conspiracies, including the assassinations of the Kennedys and John Lennon, and Swedish Premier Olof Palme. And it appears that there may actually be links between all of these. There's a book called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion that explores the international network of secret governments behind some of these coups by Ole Damgaard. And I did speak with him last month or so, went during the Project Camelot roundtable and got to know him there. And so it's an honor to introduce Ole to the show. Welcome, Ole. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very blessed. Thank you. And the honor is all mine.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. And I'm very interested in hearing about these links between various coups d'etat in different countries. You mentioned links between these assassinations that turned the USA onto a very bad track back in the 60s, the Kennedy assassinations in particular, with other events such as the sinking of the Estonia and the assassination of Olof Palme of Sweden. So why don't you introduce the audience to how you discovered the links between these different crimes against democracy?
Well, it's a long story. I think I've been doing this for about some 30-odd years. And it all started in the early 1980s when I remember I saw a documentary about the JFK assassination. And that was the first time I saw the Zapruder film, which really opened my eyes up to that something was totally wrong with the official story, that the story that we were being fed through the media could absolutely not be the correct one. So I started like a quest on my own, trying to find out what really happened there. And I almost became obsessed with the JFK assassination. So I think I read about 200 books in the subject. And after a while, it got very confusing for me because, like, I started noticing that maybe one person was mentioned in one book, and in that book he was working for the CIA. Then in another book he was working for the Chicago mob, and then in a third book he was being paid by the FBI for some services, and it got very, very confusing. So I started writing a book just for my own sake to try and sort this out, because I soon discovered that there was such a complex conspiracy, so with so many different layers, and it was almost like an enigma inside a labyrinth, inside like on many different levels.
That sounds like the line in the film JFK. Right before he was killed, that JFK witness, and I'm forgetting his name at the moment, the crazed CIA dope pilot.
David Perry.
Yeah. I said it's David a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma.
but it really is. It really is. And I mean, he knew he was right in the middle of it all. What he also said was that it was impossible to know on what side people were because they kept changing sides and kept changing roles. And so it's very, very confusing. Anyway, after I studied this for a few years, I also got very interested in the assassination of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King and the murder of Marilyn Monroe. And in the meantime, the Swedish Prime Minister was gone down in 1986. It was a late winter's night in February 1986 by what was officially called a lone crazy guy who disappeared and was not to be found. And at that time, I still thought that I lived in a beautiful democracy, a country that didn't even know how to spell corruption, and where the police was someone you could trust, and so on. And then after down the line, I started noticing almost like a template that was being used with these political assassinations. It was all, even when I studied like Abraham Lincoln all the way down to back to Julius Caesar, it was almost like there was like a template of how to commit a political assassination and get away with it, how to trick the public into thinking that it was a work of a lone crazy nut. And
well, you know, call me a conspiracy theorist, but I still say that Caesar was killed by a conspiracy, not by a lone
sure.
gunman.
No, but we're not talking about the guns, but there was conspiracies in all these cases. And then after a while, I started seeing a very clear pattern of how they did it and what was needed to commit one of these things, how they set up special, like normally they have one surveillance team that goes in like a few weeks before the hit itself. And these teams are often, it's like very often three teams of two or three people in each team that keeps the future victim under surveillance, checking out everywhere, his habits, where he's going, where he's coming, and so on. And these teams are being formed by people who don't know each other. They're often only in radio contacts with code names and so on. It's all of these operations are made on a need-to-know chain. There's a very, very strong compartmentalization where everybody just knows their part and nothing else, meaning that even if somebody decides to become a whistleblower, he will only know very little. And so you got one surveillance team. In the meantime, while these guys are checking out the victim, a patsy is normally prepared as well. And this is very often a lone crazy guy. And the reason why they claim a lone crazy guy is because if there's more than one person involved, if there's two or more, then it's by law a conspiracy. And that is something they want to avoid at any cost, because then you need an investigation, and that investigation can lead somewhere where they're not very welcome. So they choose somebody who often looks strange or says strange things or have a strange name. It's been going in, it's been like different trends. It used to be East Germans or East Bloc people from Russia and so on. Then it went into, we've had a long trend with Muslims, where these poor people are perfect in media because we've been so pumped with Islam being equal terrorism. It's just been pumped into our subconscious. And nowadays, if your name is Muhammad Abdullah or something like that, people right away connect it with terrorism, which is totally false. And but the good thing with this is for them is that if you look dark, if you got a big black mustache and you got a very long name and you come from a country they don't even know where it is, and you're being blamed for some violent crime, people will buy it right away. So that is why Muslims have been used for quite a while. Now that is coming out of fashion as well. Now they changed the trend, so now it's like very Nordic looking people or very normal looking people, meaning that they're trying to scare us into thinking that anyone can be a terrorist, anyone can be a violent guy. So
well,
anyway,
did you see that they changed the narrative of the Boston bombings? Originally, Tamerlan and Zokar Tsarnaev were supposed to be radical Muslims from Chechnya, which didn't make any sense because the radical Muslims from Chechnya are fighting the Russians with the help of the USA and especially the CIA. So that ridiculous narrative seems to be half retracted now, and they're claiming that the Tsarnaev brothers were actually 9/11 truthers and radical anti-government conspiracy theorists like you and me.
Exactly.
So I guess they're demonizing people like us now.
Yeah, that is why, because when they set up the patsy, they very often try to do it with somebody they have problems with anyway. So with the Oklahoma City bomb, for instance, they were blaming it on Timothy McVeigh and so on, because they had problems with these people building up their own small societies where they had their own laws, their own weapons and so on. And And this was something that the government had major problems with, so that's why they aimed it at this type of group that time. But very often, I mean, the next one maybe can be yogis or bird lovers or you name it, militant bird lovers or whatever. Once you look into this, it doesn't make sense. You know, it's just really stupid. Like one time I remember there was a Mexican candidate for president, I think, or vice president that was shot down, and the guy they claimed had done it was a lone crazy guy who was an he was a pacifist, you know.
So he was a radical pacifist, so he decided to
exactly
do it.
That's exactly what they say. he refused to use weapons, and he was a radical pacifist, so he shot this guy. I mean, the people who make up these plans are not very clever.
I suppose the next wave of terrorism will be the radical nonviolence extremists blowing up cities with nuclear weapons.
Or nuclear mushrooms.
That sounds like Dick Cheney would come up with something like that.
Cucumber grenades or whatever.
Right. Remember when they were saying that the pregnant women were a threat, that because the pregnancy, the belly could actually hold a bomb, and so people should be watching out for pregnant women. If you see a ticking pregnant woman, yeah. That was official TSA and Homeland Security stuff here.
I love it. I mean, they make it so obvious once you start seeing what they're doing, so it's really hilarious quite. If it wasn't so sad, you would just be laughing your head off. Anyway, so they prepared the patsy, they prepared a lot of evidence that would point his way, that they have the guy under surveillance. Then also while this is being done, they prepare their own investigation, which will be on standby before the attack itself. And that investigation is made by people in their own group, where they control the key people. It could be so that all normal, honest crime investigators or policemen and all of the honest people that would do a good job in trying to find what had actually happened, they're put out of the way. So this investigation is put on standby. And then when that is, when the date is getting close to when they want to take this guy out, they fly in the team of assassins. And this group is very often put together of people from different countries, different groups, different backgrounds, different blah, 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 so that there's no obvious connections between them. But what they've got in common is that they're very often, or they are always very skilled assassins. They can be former security people, mercenaries, soldiers, fortune, and so on. And very often highly disciplined, skilled killers who don't even know who they're gonna kill. Most of the time they're just put in there and then given this task and they perform it, and boom, then afterwards they're helped out of the country with the help of local police and so on. Regarding the local police, very often when a hit like this is done, the logistics is taken care of by local police officer, local security people, right wing people. They take care of the supply of weapons, food, housing, vehicles, and so on. And when it's time, the poor victim, they do it very cowardly. They make very sure that all bodyguards, everything else is pulled away, so that this guy walks out alone and is just being slaughtered. Then once that is done, one of the ways you can see right away that there has been a conspiracy is not what is done, but what is not done. You know, like if you or I went down to Walmart and took a brick and threw in through the shop window, within two minutes.
Not a bad idea, actually.
No, but like within a few minutes, you would be surrounded by police cars and, you know, like that. But when things like this happen, absolutely nothing happens for a long time. You know, like in the case of the Swedish Prime Minister, it took almost 3 hours before the alert went out, and it went from 11:30 at night to 5 o'clock in the morning before the real alert went out. And during that time, not even the normal police had any idea that the Prime Minister had been shot. You know, everything is just being pulled back so that the whole hit team could manage to leave the country. And then once they're out, boom, they close in the gates and say, my God, now we're really going to do a real manhunt here and hunt these killers down. So, and then down the line, you will also see a very clear pattern of when the official investigation fail in finding the real killer. I mean, if they haven't got this patsy, and if they take the patsy, very often he's shot down, or he's hurt or wounded so that he can't speak, or he's just being put away in jail to rot without having any chance to get out. But if they don't get away with the patsy, after a while, if there's more and more questions arising and people, normal people, are getting more and more frustrated and forcing them to look into it more, what they will do is that they will put an official commission. They love these commissions, where the Truth Commission or the This Commission or that Commission.
Warren Commission.
The Warren Commission. There's so many different, all of these commissions. And what these commissions will do, they're just a tool of the power behind the assassinations. What they will do is they will look into it to a small degree, and then they will spend months and months and months dragging it out, never hearing the real witnesses, just, you know, dragging out, doing absolutely nothing. And then in the end, they will come with a report saying, my God, you should have done better. And that's about it. And then if it keeps on a few years down the line, a new commission will be put on. But then that commission will be put to check out the first commission and see how they were doing. And then they drag it out so that people are so fed up. And then in the end, they will come with a report saying, my God, you should have done better. And they just keep doing that. You know, it can be like two, three different commissions down before people are so fed up. And there's been so many years that has passed that nobody cares anymore.
Right.
So, and anyway, with the JFK assassination and Robert Kennedy and so on, what I started noticing after a while as well, after many, many years, I must say, of tracking down, I managed to track down all the people involved in the Swedish assassination, which was not the work of a lone crazy guy, but it was a big military operation.
Was it the Olof Palme assassination?
The Olof Palme assassination, yes. The official story to this day is that they got the guy after 3 years or 2 years down the line, and he was sentenced for the murder, and then afterwards he was not released. Yeah, he was. They changed the verdict, and so he was released, and then afterwards a few years later, he was picked up by the police, taken to a hospital, and when he came out from the hospital, he was found with a cracked skull, and then he died a few days later. They said he had an epileptic seizure, but his skull was cracked from above, like almost 10 centimeters on top of the head. So I don't know how he managed to fall and crack his head like that.
Very, very odd. Do you think he was involved? Because in some of these cases, the patsies seem to be involved in the actual assassination. For instance, in the Breivik mass murder in Norway, it appears that he was indeed involved. But as in all of these other cases that you've described, the response was ridiculously slow. Children are being massacred on an island, and somehow the police can't find any boats to get to the island. So they just sit around and do nothing. But in any case, he was involved. On the other hand, it seems that Sirhan was hypnotized and had no idea that he was involved in killing Bobby Kennedy. And Lee Harvey Oswald was probably an FBI informant who thought that he was trying to infiltrate and stop the plot to kill JFK. So it seems that the Patsies have different levels of involvement in these things.
For sure, for sure. It's with Lee Harvey Oswald, I think you were spot on there. With Sirhan Sirhan, he was a mind control Patsy, you know, MK Ultra, as well as the guy in Norway, Breivik.
Was Breivik a mind controlled, you think?
Yes, the typical pattern of these guys are that they do the violent act, and then afterwards they just stand like zombies waiting. And they can be triggered by trigger words, and they can be stopped by words as well. And Breivik in Oslo on the island, while he was walking around shooting, he was in contact with a SWAT team on his mobile, giving reports on where he was doing, how much he had done, and so on. He was not the only shooter as well. There was at least two shooters. And then when the SWAT team finally made it, because just like you say, they couldn't find a boat, these poor guys. So there was just, it was once again, it was dragging out and dragging out and dragging out. So this, they were for I can't remember, it was for more, almost 2 hours this guy was walking around shooting people. And I mean, the distance is not far across the water. It's ridiculous. But when the police came, they came in a rubber boat, and there were so many people in this rubber boat. I don't know if you've seen the film. It's like they're like 10 people standing in this little small rubber boat. When they finally make it to the island, when they approach him, they just say, Anders Breivik. And he, as soon as he hear his name, how did they know his name? As soon as he hear his name, he just puts down a gun and just stands there waiting for them to pick him up. It's exactly the same when they use these mind control guys.
Very interesting. You know, another question about these assassinations is who benefits, and especially if we're trying to find a common thread between these different assassinations, we would be looking to see if there's a common thread of the party that benefits. And frankly, it seems to me that there is, in the American assassinations, there's a common thread in terms of the what we might call the military-industrial complex. There also seems to be perhaps a Zionist common thread. Breivik massacred the next generation of the Labour Party leaders in Norway, and they had just put out a strong pro-Palestinian platform, and it seemed to be sending a very clear message from the Israeli Mossad and the Zionists. And likewise, Bobby Kennedy's patsy, Sirhan Sirhan, was a Palestinian, and they set him up to make it look like he was killed by a radical Palestinian terrorist. John F. Kennedy was taking the power away from the Zionist-controlled Federal Reserve by printing actual American money, and he was going all out to stop the incipient Israeli nuclear program. 9/11, of course, was designed to create a 100 years war against Islam on behalf of Zionism. So in many of these cases, it seems that there's a Zionist connection. Is that the most important connection tying these things together, or are there many others as well?
I think you're spot on, but I think that it's more complex and at the same time more simple than that. Yes, there are Zionists, but the military-industrial complex, yes, but both of these are totally, but they're also so infiltrated into each other. So it's very difficult to say that, or I would say it's a mistake to say it was this or that. It's both of them. And yes, the Fed Express are involved as well. And in this top of the pyramid, as far as up as I go, because I know there's layers above it, but in that layer, you got the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderberg Group. These three, I'm very definitely convinced that these are very deeply involved in, I would say, more or less all of these big conspiracies. It's like, I must say, I don't think there is such a thing as a real terrorist. I must say that, because every time I look into a so-called terror act, it, when you dig deep enough, you come back to the same roots or the same group behind it. They're using different mechanics, but very often they're even using the same mechanics, and that is one of the things that that I'm really interested in.
But by mechanics, you mean the killers, the professional killers?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is one thing that I would like to talk about a little, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
It's in the early 1960s, President Eisenhower had, they were very afraid of Fidel Castro's takeover on Cuba and so on. So Eisenhower asked his colleague, Richard Nixon, to put together a team of assassins. It was called the Operation 40, and this Operation 40 was named so because there was 40 assassins, mostly exiled Cubans, former policemen, former military guys from Cuba, very hard, hard disciplined, well disciplined men, brutal. And this team was put together and trained, and one of the guys that was given the task to help to finance this operation was George Herbert Walker Bush, the senior Bush. It was not him paying, but he was the guy who got the money from oil men in Texas and the military industrial complex and so on, and pumped in to finance this. It was trained to be aimed at Castro, and they did several attacks on Fidel Castro without never succeeding. But then when Kennedy became a problem for them, they just changed and moved the cannon towards him instead.
And that was a lot easier because they could control the bodyguards. They could take away Kennedy's protection, and they never could do that with Castro because Castro was surrounded by loyal people.
Yeah, exactly. So once again, a very cowardly ambush, this thing. But when you look at, when you identify all the shooters, which I believe I have in Dealey Plaza, many of them were members of Operation 40, or very closely attached to this group of assassins. And I don't know if you want me to name them, or otherwise I can just...
Sure, continue. Yeah, please name some names.
Okay, so... If you go to Dealey Plaza, I think your listeners are quite aware of the layout of Dealey Plaza and so on. I would think so, yeah?
Well, I mean, it wouldn't hurt to just briefly summarize it again.
Okay. It's a very complex plaza. I mean, the streets go in very, very odd ways. And the reason why they chose this place was, for one thing, it was a Freemasonry place. There was a Freemasonry obelisk, and they loved to... almost like ritual killings. When you look at many of these killings, there's very often some kind of Freemasonry symbolism or ritual or significance with the actual spot where they get killed. Very often the date and these type of things, for some reason, I don't know really why they do it, but there's a very clear pattern. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the reason why they picked this place was, for one, that some of the buildings had CIA offices in it, or covert operations going on inside these buildings, the school book depository and the Deltex building. But also that they managed to change the route of the convoy so that they really slowed it down massively, breaking all security rules, so that the limo with Kennedy had to slow down, so it was going very, very slowly when it passed the school book depository, making it a perfect place for an ambush. And people are talking, was it one shooter or was it two shooters? There was multiple shooters in the Dealey Plaza, as far as I've been able to find out. In the if we start from, you got the county prison. That was the first building, if we start from the right-hand side. Up on that roof, there was a deputy police officer called Harry Weatherford, who was a very good sharpshooter. He was positioned on top of that roof. Then in the Daltex building, underneath the fire escape on the second floor, there was one shooter. His name was Chucky Nicoletti. He was from the Chicago mob, a hitman there. And he had a spotter. There are very often one shooter and one spotter, or one spotter and two shooters in these teams. And his spotter, his name was Nestor Izquierdo. He was very closely connected to Operation 40, even though he was not an original member. By the way, there's a statue of him in Miami as a freedom fighter.
Oh, okay. Boy. And somebody maybe should take some spray paint to that.
Well, there you go. I mean, they see themselves as freedom fighters, but I think these guys are the real terrorists. speaking of more terrorists, in that building as well, in the same room, was Johnny Rosselli, which was the connection with the Chicago mob, between the Chicago mob and Operation 40, and also the military industrial complex that was there as well. In that building as well was George Bush Sr. It's come out now that he was actually in that building when the shots were fired from the Dole 6 building.
Really? Because, yeah, he's photographed meeting with Edward Lansdale, the CIA's number one assassination specialist, in front of the book depository, I believe.
Yeah.
So and then he said he didn't remember where he was.
Once you start tracking down this guy, I mean, we're talking being criminal on a level that is, like, unheard of during his life. Totally, totally, totally.
I think that, you know what, should go on H.W. Bush's tombstone, if, you know, and then hopefully this will, he'll put one up soon. The great quote, you know, that always comes to mind is when he told the journalist Sarah McClendon, she asked, you know, what would happen if the American people found out the truth about what you've been doing? And he said,
they would lynch them.
They would chase us down the street and lynch us.
Yeah. Oh, he's
true
very
words
right.
Were never spoken.
No, because if normal people really knew what he had been up to, he and his family, I mean, it's incredible, absolutely incredible when you track it down. Anyway, he was arrested just when he came out of the Doltex building, and that made a bit of confusion, because they once they discovered who he was, they wanted to cover it over. So the official story says that the guy they actually took there was a guy called Hale Braden, who is also a mob figure. And this Hale Braden, according to himself, was in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles when Robert Kennedy was murdered as well. Anyway, if we go to the
I wonder what the coincidence theorists make of that. I mean, if you're not a conspiracy theorist for these things, you think, wow, what a coincidence. The same criminal-connected guy just happens to show up right at the spot where both the Kennedy brothers get killed.
This is the thing. I mean, it's very important not to get carried away, because there could be such a thing as a coincidence. But once you see that they just get repeated and repeated and repeated, it's sort of like it becomes a joke. You see.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, you know, the same person innocently happening to be on the scene of the killings of both Kennedy brothers. That's about maybe 1 in 100 million. But yeah, it could happen. But it's 1 in 100 million. But if you start piling up a large number of 1 in 100 million coincidences, then you can be pretty sure that they're not coincidences.
There you go. It's like I'm a very simple person. You know, it's like I've got what I call Farmer Brown mentality. It doesn't matter who says anything else, but 1 + 1 = 2. If you come in a fancy white coat with a big title before it, and you're some kind of scientist saying that 1 + 1 = 34, it's just not true. And with many of these conspiracies, if you look at them, they're no-brainers. You don't have to be very smart to figure out right away that, my God, this is just not true.
Well, the obvious, you know, the Building 7 in the JFK assassination for me was not so much the magic bullet that everybody talks about, although that's pretty obvious, but you have to work at reconstructing the trajectory, and it takes a little bit of, you know, cerebral activity. But all you have to do is look at that live broadcast, or the tape of the live broadcast of Jack Ruby walking through a bunch of Dallas police officers who step out of his way, and he's got Ruby with his drawn gun, walks through a crowd of cops, just walks right up to Oswald, who supposedly killed JFK, and shoots him dead. And Ruby's a mob hitman. You know, if a mob hitman walks through a sea of police officers with a drawn gun and shoots the guy who supposedly shot the president, you know, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to realize what's going on.
It's like with Robert Kennedy, Sirhan is in front of him, like a meter and a half in front of him, with a gun with, I think it was 8 bullets. He shoots 8 times, but there are like 13 bullets. There's 13 shots being fired, and there are people being hit right, left, and center. And
so then five bullets. 5 bullets in thin air.
Yeah, where did they come from? And then Robert Kennedy is killed by 3 shots from the back, from the right rear. 3 times from the right rear, and Sirhan was always right in front of him. I mean, how you can't, it's just impossible. So you need to logically just see who was standing to the right and to behind Robert Kennedy, and that's where the real shooter was. And this guy was a guy also connected to the Chicago mob, a man called Thane Caesar, who was worked extra as a security guard that evening. But speaking about controlled, mind-controlled killers, I think that he was mind-controlled as well, because I don't think that he was really aware of what he had done, because he even went through a lie detector test afterwards and passed it. So this is what...
I think these guys are trained to beat lie detector tests. You know, one big clue as to how all of this works is the wonderful book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which describes how these banksters recruit people by testing them. It turns out that John Perkins, the economic hitman, was recruited because he had covered up a relatively minor crime involving his friend and done it very skillfully, and then it was found out. But rather than, you know, punishing him, these bankster, you know, deep state criminals decided to hire him. So he was hired by the, you know, the equivalent of the IMF to go convince heads of state to accept huge loans from the World Bank that would basically sell their countries up the river. And they would never be able to pay the loans back, and the banksters would come in and take all the valuable goods in those countries. And Perkins says this is part of a world takeover attempt. These people are trying to take over the world using usury as their main weapon, and violence is only their secondary weapon. Anyway, but the point is that when these guys recruited Perkins to be an economic hitman, they also are recruiting similar people, only nastier people, to be actual hitmen, the so-called asteroids that Perkins knows and describes. Yeah. And these asteroids, obviously, are psychopaths. Now, psychopaths, as I'm sure you know, don't have the same kinds of emotional reactions that non-psychopaths have, and that's why they make such great hitmen. And, you know, they've done 95% of the killing in all wars as well. They can kill a human as easy as they can kill a fly. They don't feel guilty about it, and they don't feel guilty about lying. So the reason that lie detectors work is because ordinary people feel a little bit guilty about lying, and that actually affects their galvanic skin response. But a psychopath doesn't feel guilty about lying, so the easiest thing in the world is to train a psychopath to be A, a professional killer, and B, a guy who can beat lie detector tests. So this character who shot RFK, my guess is not so much that he's necessarily mind-controlled. I would say probably just really well-trained, and it's a no-brainer that he would be able to beat a lie detector.
Might very well possibly be like that. Anyway, if we go back to Dealey Plaza, if we go to the school book depository on the sixth floor where the so-called Oswald, the sniper's nest, in that window, I don't think there were any shots fired from that window, but the shooter there was one of the members from Operation 40. His name was Eladio Del Valle. He was actually murdered the same day as David Ferry, if anyone recognized this. He was a pilot who was involved in this assassination. I was also supposed to fly people out, one of them being Oswald that day. Anyway, the spotter on that sixth floor, his name was Arminio Diaz Garcia. He was a black exile Cuban member of the Operation 40 as well. He had done several... one attempt on Castro and another on one Latin American dictator, but that failed. Anyway, and on the same floor, on the left-hand side, the shooter there, his name was Richard Kane from the Chicago mob. He was one of Sam Giancana's close associates. Anyway, then if we go down to the grassy knoll, if we go halfway towards the picket fence, there's a white Chevy parked, and there's a shooter there. You can very easily spot him if you see I think it's Mary Mormon, the photo, and also one of the films. He's standing with his almost with his elbow on the roof of the car, aiming right at the president limo in a white shirt, and either that is Frank Fiorini or Frank Sturgis or Roscoe White from the Dallas police department. Frank Sturgis was also one of the main members in this Operation 40. He was also involved in many, many dirty, awful, violent things, including the Watergate burglary. Then if we continue to the towards the picket fence, there's one guy in a police uniform, a black Dallas police uniform. His name was Lucien Sarti, and he was a French assassin from the Marseille mob that was brought in by the Chicago Mafia to take part of this assassination as well. Next to him was a guy in a railroad worker outfit. That this guy, I've never been able to figure out who he is, but he was there. And then if you go towards the tree behind the picket fence, the shooter there, his name was James Files. He's still alive. He's in prison now. And he claims to be the one that shot the final headshot, the fatal one that just blew JFK's head open. And then the last one, his name was Jack Lawrence. He was shooting from the front from a manhole. That is where one of the bullets go right through the windscreen of the limo. That's the first one that hits Jack right in the throat. And then behind the picket fence, there was a person that said that he was from the Secret Service. That stopped people when they started running up towards the grassy knoll, trying to get hold of the killer because they had seen gun smoke coming out underneath the tree. And this guy was later identified as Bernard Baker, who was also a member of Operation 40 and also one of the Watergate burglars. Then in Dealey Plaza. Dealey Plaza this day was like filled with people from organized crime and assassins from everywhere, especially from Operation 40. It was like a who's who. In Dealey Plaza that day, there was people like Orlando Bosch.
They should have put up a sign like in those motels when they have conventions, welcome assassins.
It's exactly like that. It's like if Michael Jackson had a concert in Stockholm, then all the rock stars from Sweden would be there to see him. And it was one of these events. It really was. All of them were there this day, which also made it really confusing to identify who did what and why they were there and so on.
Right. Howard Hunt of the CIA, in his deathbed confession to his son, St. John Hunt, said that the code name for the Kennedy assassination was the big event.
Yeah.
And it sounds like people in that milieu regarded it as kind of the big, you know, the big event. It was like the Rolling Stones concert or something. Everybody had it.
Exactly. And they saw it like that. They were really proud of being there and so on. So, then the three tramps that were later, they were found in one of the train wagons and taken away by Dallas police. They were taken downtown to the police station, but then released right away without any track. The people, these three tramps, were Chauncey Holt. He used to work for the CIA, and this day he was there to. He was the one who had helped printing all the fake Secret Service IDs and so on that was handed out to different people. And he I don't think he had any idea of that it was actually Kennedy that was being shot that day, but. This is he's the old tramp. Then you got the tall, so-called tall tramp. His name was it's Woody Harrelson's father. Woody Harrelson, the father, Jack Harrelson. I think so. Oh my God, my mind just went blank there. But Charles Harrelson, sorry about that. Charles Harrelson, he's the tall one. And he was later put away because he shot a judge in San Antonio, John Brown, and then he was put away until he died there. And then the last of these three tramps that was also involved in this assassination in different ways, his name was Charles Rogers, or it was a code name, and very charming guy. They later found out that he had killed his parents and chopped them up and put them in the fridge, and then he disappeared. I don't know what happened to this guy afterwards. Anyway, but you also have there's one guy with a black umbrella. He's called the Umbrella Man. He's standing.
Yeah, that's right. Just as the limousine goes by, the umbrella opens and closes a couple of times.
Yeah. Exactly. He opens it, and the reason why he opens it was because there were shooters all over the place, and they needed to mark a spot so that everybody knew when to start shooting, because it wouldn't be any good if like people were shooting all over the place, you know, during half a minute or something like that. Then they couldn't blame it on one patsy. Everybody had to shoot at the same time. So they put this guy to just mark the point where this is where we start shooting. And his name was Roy Hargraves. He was also a mercenary close to Operation 40. And the guy in front of him, there's a guy standing waving in front of him. His name was Felipe Vidal Santiago. This guy is very, very interesting because after Dealey Plaza, after this Dallas event, he worked for the CIA during many years, and one of his tasks, he was both in Africa and the States and in Europe and so on, one of his tasks was to hire assassins for different hits. And believe it or not, but this guy was in Stockholm, 1986, that's like 25 years later, trying to hire people to do the hit on Olof Palme, the Swedish Prime Minister.
Wow.
So there's a direct link there between Dallas and Stockholm to that assassination. And I got another one for you, because in this Operation 40, there was one man called David Attlee Phillips. He was way, way high, very high ranking in the CIA. And he was the so-called controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was the guy, he was the stationer chief in Mexico City. He was one of the guys who really manipulated Lee Harvey Oswald into doing all these.
Did he have direct contact with Oswald? Because I know George de Morenschild confessed to having been Oswald's CIA controller. Was Phillips also directly dealing
Yeah, for sure. Attlee Phillips was above Morenschild. Mm-hmm. And another guy was Ted Shackley, who is called the Blonde Ghost. He was also extremely involved both in the JFK assassination, but many, many, many others all over the world. But this David Attlee Phillips, he was not only the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald, he was also the controller of James Files, one of the shooters, the guy behind the picket fence. And James Files has been very active as well during the years afterwards. He was... among other things, he was part of the bomb hit on Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C. Do you remember that, when they blew up his car in Washington Row?
Yeah, that was after the coup d'etat of September 11th, 1971, when they overthrew Allende. And this was some blowback from that, when they were killing Letelier because he was an anti-Allende activist here in the U.S.
Exactly, because these guys in Operation 40, one of them, he wasn't really an active member, but he was very close to this group. His name was Michael Vernon Townley, or still is, he's still around. He was also controlled by David Attlee Phillips. And one of the tasks he was given was that he was sent to Chile and was taking part of the overthrow of Salvador Allende. That was supervised by David Attlee Phillips and very strongly supported by Henry Kissinger, among other people directly involved. And this Michael Vernon Townley, he's also crucial in many hits all over the world. And one of the hits, or one of the things he did, he was also in Stockholm that day when Olof Palme was shot that evening. And one of the... If we go back to 1973, when they overthrew Allende, one of the tasks that David Attlee Phillips gave Michael Vernon Townley was to start two groups of assassins that was part of Operation Condor. The Operation Condor was to track down these sympathizers of Salvador Allende and just kill them. Wherever they were, all over the world, just track them down and kill them. And... in these two groups that Michael Vernon Townley created, two of the killers in that, there was one called Roberto Tieme and another one called Julio Izquierdo. These two assassins were also in Stockholm that day when Olof Palme was shot. Once again, you know, these strange, strange circumstances, or but it's very obvious that, my God, how big are the chances?
Right. Well, you know, it sounds like we might not have to arrest all that many people to put a dent in these kinds of killings. You know, no, it's the same guys that keep doing it. Let's just arrest them, and maybe we can stop this global crime wave.
But that's what that's exactly how I feel. You know, if we stop, if this group just let go of stop the madness, I mean, this planet will turn into a beautiful place because they're behind so much of what of the horrible things going on, everything from wars and terror attacks and crimes against humanity. You track it and it's back to the same people, back to the same people, back to the same people. So it's a very small group, I would say, which makes me very optimistic.
How do you think they organize themselves? You know, it's you know, Perkins has explained how he was recruited, and I suppose it was easier for him to justify what he did because he was just an economic hitman, and they had this sort of line that they could say, well, we're actually bringing civilization to these places as we, you know, turn them into debt slaves. At least we're bringing them into this world system that we're creating. And I think, though, that these really grotesque criminal operations, these assassinations and terror attacks and murders of innocent people and the killings of the best, most moral leaders of so many countries, it seems to me that this would be really hard for people to justify to themselves. And if you're building an organization that's going to be doing this, you know, how do you get coherence? I mean, these people like Jack Ruby was just a complete, you know, he didn't have, seem to have any loyalty to anybody, and he was willing to talk once he was in prison. I mean, these psychopaths normally are pretty much disloyal. They just are in it for themselves. So how in the world do they create this kind of organization and keep it all, you know, keep everybody on the same page? It's kind of mind-boggling.
I don't think it's very strange. Most of them are very proud of what they've done. You know, they're not ashamed at all. And this is also why it's very good for someone like me, because people like that, they often start bragging, you know, if they get drunk or they can't keep it to themselves. They want to show off and so on. So there's a lot of these people who have told their lawyers, told their friends, told this and that about their part, but always feeling proud of themselves because they see them, you know, like Jack Kennedy among these people was seen as an absolute traitor. So so they were happy to get rid of him.
Right. Yeah. Howard Hunt seemed to have mixed feelings, possibly because his son, St. John, was horrified by the Kennedy assassination. And, you know, I wonder how many of them are ambivalent and how many are, as you say, just proud of what they do.
No, Howard Hunt hated Kennedy. He hated them. Absolutely. After the way he saw it was that the JFK let them down on the Bay of Pigs. Bay of Pigs. My God, I'm tired. And so he hated the guy. He was very happy to see him go. Anyway, if I go back to some of the members in this Operation 40, because I think that it's very important to get this info out because they're so central in so many of these historical so-called events. We have another guy called David Sanchez Morales. He was way up in Operation 40 as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was deeply involved in the trying to overthrow Fidel Castro. He was also involved in trying to overthrow the president of Guatemala. And he was at Dili Plaza that day. He was also in Laos. He was part of capturing Che Guevara under the surveillance of his officer and comrade from Operation 40, Felix Rodriguez. And David Morales was also at the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was killed. And he was also the guy who actually shot Che Guevara, even though it was Felix Rodriguez who gave the order. Felix Rodriguez is another very central guy. He was George Herbert Walker Bush right-hand assassin for many years. And he was also very central in the Iran-Contras scandal, working closely with Oliver North. He also walks around with Che Guevara's watch to this day, if he's still around. I know 2004 he was president of the Bay of Pigs Veterans Association, so I think he's still around. But he was also, like I say, deeply involved in the Iran-Contras, where what happened was that weapons from the National Guard were stolen, as far as I know, under the surveillance of Colin Powell, and they got rid of the serial numbers, and then these weapons were transported out of the country with medevac airplanes going to Nicaragua or Guatemala, these countries. And then on the return, these flights were filled up, especially the nose cone was filled up with tons and tons of cocaine and other hard drugs. And they were flown into Arkansas. There was a small, there's a small town there called Mena, and they had a small airstrip there where all these planes came in during the nights. And just this was where the whole crack epidemia started, and how the whole thing was just pumped out into the States. And that was done with Felix Rodriguez, and the person who was responsible for receiving these were the governor at that time, Bill Clinton, who later That's became right. president. And also George Bush was there several times. Another guy who was very central in Iran-Contras was Barry Seals, who was also part of Operation 40. He was a pilot who was very skilled and also was at Dealey Plaza. He was flying people into the JFK assassination. I do believe that he might have been flying people out from the Martin Luther King assassination as well.
You've probably heard about the Philip Marshall assassination recently. Philip Marshall had actually flown Barry Seal around for a while and was working with Barry Seal, and Philip Marshall just died along with his two children. The police are calling it a murder-suicide by himself. And
No.
Yeah, what do you think about that case?
Absolute bullshit. It's so obvious. Because he was starting to speak openly about this, and so he was taken out for sure.
Yeah, it seems to me people in that line of work, Operation 40 people who write a book saying 9/11 was an inside job, probably aren't making themselves very popular with some of their colleagues.
Nope.
Well, you know, I think we're just about at the end of our hour, but I'm sure there's a lot more. You've certainly named plenty of names. Which is great, and I invite Felix Rodriguez to come sue us and claim that he doesn't wear Che Guevara's wristwatch. He doesn't. So, you know, naming names, it's you got to do it. I mean, it's one of the benefits of being in the alternative media, where we don't have to worry about them coming and taking away our multimillion-dollar operation, because we don't have a multimillion-dollar operation. All right, well, thank you so much. It's been a very interesting hour, Ole, and I look forward to exploring more of your work. You have more than one book out, and I'm looking forward to reading them and bringing you back on.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care and keep up the good work. God bless you.
Can I just mention my website is lightonconspiracies.com.
Okay.
Lightonconspiracies.com, and my book is called Coup d'etat in slow motion.
Coup d'etat and in slow motion.
In slow motion, because this is exactly what happened, that it was not a coup d'etat, like a violent overnight coup d'etat, but a slow moving coup d'etat, so that no one would really notice what had happened.
That's a very good title. I look forward to it. Thank you so much for your work, and talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Ole Damegård. He's from Sweden, and he has written that fascinating book, Coup d'etat in slow motion. His website is lightonconspiracies.com, and we'll be bringing him back to talk about this and other subjects in the near future. God willing, I'm planning to be in Iran soon, and he's has a whole book out about Iranian topics, so we'll take that one up on a future show. I'm Kevin Barrett. This is one of my summer vacation specials here on nolizradio.org. And if you want to get on my list and get notified about my shows, just go to truthjihad.com and join as a member. Or you can always email me at kbarrett, that's K-B-A-R-R-E-T-T, at mer.com, that's M-E-R-R.com. And I do hope to see you at the Million American March Against Fear in Washington, D.C. on September 11th. Of this upcoming year. That's less than a month away now. go to the million, or just Google the Million American March to find out more. It's getting all kinds of publicity now, and so we do expect to have a pretty good turnout of people supporting freedom in the Constitution, calling for a new investigation of 9/11, and
we fought, we learned, we struggled, we won.